The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hi guys, you're listening to That's Mint on Fresh FM, broadcasting across the top of the south on 104.8 Nelson Tasman, 107.2 Nelson CBD, 88.9 Blenheim, 95.0 Eastern Golden Bay, and streaming to the planet on freshfm.co.nz. Hey everybody.
Hi guys.
Welcome Hi. Back. This is the first episode of the year, which is so exciting. Hey. I hope everyone had a good holiday, a good Christmas. We're starting it back with an interview with none other than Tanya Knox's mother, Daphne, which I'm sure everyone who's listening knows who Tanya is. I'm Imogen.
I'm Avalon.
And I'm Grace.
And would you like to introduce yourself, Daphne?
Yeah, I'm Daphne Knock, as you say, mother of Tanya. I do have other attributes as well. And it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon, a real privilege to share my story with you all.
Well, it's an amazing story.
Yeah. Before we get into it, Imogen, would you like to explain our new series that we've got going on and our plans for the radio show for this year?
That's a good idea. So for this year, I've been doing some thinking about what we should do, and Mint Together has decided that we're going to do a series where we interview mothers from all around the world, and they tell their immigration stories coming to New Zealand either as former refugees or as immigrants. And we just get a little bit of background and detail on women's stories who usually get overlooked, you know? Mm-hmm. I think it will be a nice start to the year.
Yeah. I'm so excited.
It's going to be so cool. Good. Yeah. So I guess you're the first of many.
What a privilege.
So yeah, let's start it up.
Okay. So Daphne, how was your understanding of multiculturalism shaped by your upbringing? Because you come from Uganda, correct?
Yes. And for those of you who know about Uganda, it was one of many, many British colonies or territories. Therefore, people from all over the world, or the British Empire as it was in those days, would collectively come to places like Uganda to work physically and also to help shape the country. Yeah. That's what my parents did. They came from India, both of them Indians, but for wanting a different life, an adventurous life, they decided to come to Uganda to help build a new nation. And therefore, multiculturalism, which was what your question is, was it just fell about naturally because we had a number of diverse cultures approach Uganda. So we had people from the East and the West all working together and sharing their cultures and contributing to the strata of the nation.
Oh, wow.
Yes, so I grew up with a range of different cultures, for want of a different term. And so we just, it seemed at the time, it seemed to work successfully until I grew up and became a teenager and started questioning the different levels within the strata of that country.
Yeah, once you got a little bit older and you became a little bit more aware of what was going
Absolutely. On. Absolutely. Because, you know, as a child, you just grow up, everything is good. As long as you're fed and you're happy and looked after, you do. And Uganda was a beautiful country. Well, it still is. And I was born in a little town called Jinja, right on the River Nile.
Oh, wow.
And we also had Lake Victoria. So I grew up with all kinds of animals roaming around, hippos, crocodiles. Wow. But as children, we were just allowed to roam freely. There were no rules and regulations, health and safety.
When you were smaller, was it quite safe?
It was safe, yes. Wow. Well, it was, if it wasn't safe, it was more of a survival exercise. So you ran away if you saw a snake coming towards you.
Okay. So the next question we've got for you is, did you experience any racial segregation in Uganda, which I guess you kind of touched on just previously?
Yeah, once you got older.
Yes,
once I got older and I was able to question
yeah.
what was going on, I realized that there were three distinct, separate layers within that country. There were the ruling whites at the top, mm-hmm. or the British, and Europeans were included in that top group. I think it was all based on skin color,
right.
because in the middle came the Asians, the Indians, mm-hmm. and right at the bottom were, ironically, the indigenous African population. Yeah. So I then started to realize that there were certain places which were no-go areas for certain people
mm-hmm.
because you were not white enough or you were not black enough.
Did you go to a school with a mix of different ethnic groups? Or?
Not to begin with.
Mm.
After independence, yes, then we started getting other cultures wanting to come to our school because it probably had a very good reputation. It was purely for Indians at one time.
Oh, interesting.
And it had Indian teachers, a few European teachers who were called in from abroad mm-hmm. for specific subjects. But because of the high academic level of that school, we then got a good mix towards the end
okay.
of my schooling. But it was very much segregated up until then. The Europeans had the best facilities, and the school was right at the top of a hill, very beautiful surroundings. And Africans, very few were allowed to go to school in the sense that they could not afford to go to school
because
the fees were too high.
And so these, like the segregation, it wasn't implemented by law? Or was it more just societally, this is the way that's the, I
well,
don't know?
Well, in a way, there was a law because you know, if somebody says to you, you can't admit your children into a certain school, it's kind of statutory.
Yeah.
A statement, isn't it? So, no. So, the poor African children, A, they didn't have enough money to pay for the school fees.
Right.
And that was what got to me as a teenager, because in order to start school, some children had to go to work and earn some money. So they were quite old when they started.
That's crazy to think about.
Absolutely, because I had kids in my year who were about 20.
Right.
Yeah, and I was 13 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine the disparity with the ages.
Did a lot of this segregation have impact on why you left Uganda?
Not really, because I did very well personally. Mm. You see, from a personal standpoint, I had no gripes or complaints.
Yeah.
I did well at school and I got the equivalent of A-levels in the UK.
Right.
So it enabled me to enter university in the UK if I chose to.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do music.
Mm.
So off I went to the UK. And there was no problem with that. I could go to the UK to study and leave my beloved Uganda.
And that was because it was a colony or a territory, so you had British citizenship?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
And so did my parents,
funnily
enough, and possibly my grandparents, because India was under British rule for a very long time. So all of them were British subjects,
what
citizens.
What about the like local, the native people? They were also British citizens, the Africans?
Yes, up until independence.
Okay.
If they chose to leave the country and they needed to establish their nationality, then they could apply for British.
Mm-hmm.
But they would be kind of second-class British. There were several layers of British citizenship.
Mm, that's interesting.
But after independence, they could take up Ugandan citizenship.
Right.
Because they were born there, so naturally they would be entitled to. I was born in Uganda, but I was not entitled to Uganda citizenship. I did apply for it, but I didn't get it. And that's what I mean, you know, with the different layers, there was a segregation. So I thought if I applied for Uganda citizenship, I could get a scholarship to go to the UK and then return and work in that country.
Mm.
But unfortunately, you know, the prime ministers and the rulers of Uganda had different ideas.
Yeah, and that was later on that that all
later
happened.
Was, yes, and then some awful things happened.
Yeah,
under the rule of a person called Idi Amin, who is down in history as one of the most the vilest tyrants that you can imagine, ruling a country.
Okay.
Anything else you'd like to know about part?
One of my questions here is kind of like why you left Uganda, and you've said that that was for your education and to go over to England. Did you have no intention of staying there, though? Or was it always to go back?
I didn't think. In those days, you just, well, I suppose just like youngsters do today, you live for the moment.
Yeah.
And you just want to get through your subject, you want to pass, you want to get some qualifications, and then you decide what to do. But my intentions were to go back to my family who lived in Uganda at the time and maybe work as a music teacher or whatever music could offer. So that was the intention, but it didn't happen.
No.
Purely because things got really toxic in Uganda. And it wasn't safe to go back. And by that time, Tanya was born.
Right.
I stayed. I remained in the UK. But my experiences in the UK were interesting because when I first arrived, I had some idea that there was a lot of prejudice. I was warned about colour bars and, you know, colour prejudice and racial prejudice. So all these terms go around in your head.
Yeah.
You don't fully understand until you experience something.
Oh, and so as an Asian in Uganda, you'd never experienced that before?
Only very overtly if an African shouted at you something like, you know, in Swahili it would be, Indian, go home.
Right.
And that was my home anyway.
Yeah.
You know, where do I go? I wasn't going to go back to India because I never lived there. That type of thing, but it wasn't
aggressive?
You know, cutting type of comment that made you feel, oh gosh, you know, I'm not happy here. You kind of bypassed it.
Yeah.
Because you knew they had no power to push you out.
Right.
So, but coming to Britain was a new experience for me. For a start, it was really cold and icy as I got out of the plane. And, you know, I came with my mother. And my cousin, who lived in London, met us. And we walked down the West End, you know, walked down the street, and we found people staring at us. And I said, kind of said, why are they staring at us? You know, haven't they seen Indians before? And he said, well, probably you're dressed so well. I mean, we put on our best clothes when we came, you know, to the UK. That they didn't expect that. They're probably expecting you to be dressed in a sort of very sort of low level.
Yeah, interesting.
Yes, you can imagine what they were expecting.
Yeah, of course.
And then we walked by some some houses. They call them boarding houses,
you know,
which open the doors to people wanting to spend the night or whatever. And I noticed a sign, not just one sign, but several, saying no dogs, no Irish, no blacks. And my cousin educated me at that point and said, by the way, whilst you're in Britain, you are black. You may, your skin colour may be something else, but because politically you're not white British, everybody else fits into the other category, which is black. So I learned that. I thought, okay, I don't mind that. I'm happy with that, being black. But I suddenly felt very unwelcome. And as I said to someone else before, I almost apologised for breathing the air in that country.
That's such a horrible feeling to think about.
Yes, it is. It's pretty horrible. So I started thinking, you know, I started getting regrets about coming here. Anyway, by the time I got to Dartington, which is where I went to study, it was a totally different experience.
Okay.
Because it's a very forward-thinking school and absolutely wonderful, embracing all cultures, the music of different cultures. And interestingly enough, Tanya went there 20 years later. Yes, 20
what,
years
later. Like, how did you find out about the school? Was it like a place you'd always dreamed about, or coincidentally you found it?
It was my music teacher in Uganda. Because she had spent a term there just doing a prep course or something.
Oh,
and she said,
so
well,
lovely.
If you go to England to do music, you must go to Dartington. It's special. And it's pretty special. If you Google Dartington College of Arts or Dartington Hall even and learn the background history, yeah, it's absolutely amazing. We haven't got time to talk about it now. But that, you know, so I had 3 years of absolute bliss and I did my favorite subject and I really enjoyed myself there. And then the world started to hit me, you know, as I started teaching in schools and learning the experience of different children.
And you were teaching music at the time, correct?
I was teaching in primary. I taught in secondary, but I continued to teach in a primary school, and that included music. But I also retrained in maths.
Okay.
And I did a kind of, you know, higher diploma in maths education, which took me through the history of mathematics.
Yes.
As we know it now. And taught in schools. And that was so interesting. Such an eye-opener.
Yeah.
To look at the origins of mathematics. Because we all think of it as a European concept. But oh no.
In reality, it's quite different.
In reality, our math, our number system is Hindu-Arabic. It's a combination of those two cultures. The Hindus gave us zero. And try calculating in Roman numerals.
Yeah.
Try multiplying without place value. It's impossible. So, you know, you think, okay, so the Indians gave us a zero. The Arabs gave us the number system as it is and geometry and algebra. Al, by the way, first letter of the Islamic or the Arabic alphabet, Al. And you think of all the words that begin with Al. Algebra, alchemy, anything else? You think about it. So why were children in schools never taught where their maths came from? And there was China, of course, and Africa. And, you know, the rest of the world gave us design and geometry and so on. We were using them in Europe. We were using all this learning and in science.
And
we were learning
the credit
about black achievement, and yet the children were never taught this in schools.
Yeah.
Your parents, you know, would probably never have heard of some very famous inventors, very important people, actually, without whom we wouldn't be able to store blood, for example. We wouldn't be able to run a steam engine in those days without lubricating it. These are all achievements of black inventors. And yet, school children were never taught this.
I didn't know that. We're not even taught that.
Well,
now.
Yeah, this is it. You see, why is all this stuff hidden? And it was, so I thought, well, if it's not there, somebody has to put it there.
Yeah.
So I decided at that time, and I, fortunately for me, I had a I was in a government project, tried to promote racial equality in schools, to look at the achievement of all children, all groups, assess why certain groups were underachieving, and then put in, inject as much multiculturalism as possible, if that was going to help. So I created a book on multicultural mathematics, and at the time we had a prime minister who suddenly put the dampers on it and called the project that I worked on Loony Lefties. So we had people come, interrogate us, look at our works. So we had a lot of opposition, you know, in promoting
This seems anything. Like such a strange thing to consider controversial.
Mm. Yeah, like maths. Maths and like this truly teaching people like where your stuff comes from. Like it's not even like not real, you know? You're just saying, yeah. you're just it's stating not, that math is created not. This way. It's not an opinion. It's just fact.
But what is it doing? It's showing the world that black people mm-hmm. or Asians were not only good at providing good food, takeaways, or in the case of black boys, the only good that comes out of black power, you know, the blackness is mm-hmm. music
yeah.
or sport. So black kids can only do sport or music and achieve in those, but they can't do maths or science no. or the hard core subjects.
Yeah.
So I wanted to inject stuff into the curriculum which showed that almost all our education came from those very cultures that people wanted to deny. That's and this amazing. Is, in a way, challenging the power that existed.
Yeah.
Mm. So if you want to keep people suppressed, you make out that they're not capable of doing stuff.
Yeah.
And so I looked at the figures, you know, the stats on all the important examinations. And we had, interestingly enough, the top group were the Chinese. And then we had Indian. And then we had white boys, white girls. And right at the bottom were the black Caribbean girls and boys.
Oh, that's us.
That's us.
I was like, ooh.
Well, yeah. That's yeah, it.
This is true.
Now, how do you feel about that?
Pissed off.
Yeah, that's
because
not great.
Yeah. I know that's not actually anything and like a reflection of our own brains. It's like of circumstance.
Yeah, and our environment.
Yeah.
And I suppose our treatment within
and like
society.
Yeah, if people think yeah. you're incapable, why would you try? There's yeah. already like this impression and expectation
and
stereotype put on us. So
absolutely.
Why fight it?
Yeah. Mm.
There's no point.
Yeah. yeah. I think there's also, we've got quite high rates of dyslexia as well.
Mm.
Like our whole language in Jamaica, Patois, is like
face dyslexic.
It's dyslexic. Everything is spelt phonetically. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe in that way, our brains might work a little bit differently, but that doesn't make us incapable of learning.
If you think about Caribbean black history,
yeah.
a lot of it, we were never educated.
This
like,
is true.
These are some of the first generations of Caribbean black people to be educated.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, that's. And what you're reflecting
mm-hmm.
is actually the picture that was in Britain. And I'm sure Grace has probably got some examples. And of similarities going on, maybe
here in New Zealand.
New Zealand,
yeah, definitely. I feel like with a lot of like with education, especially with Māori people, I feel there's a lot of definitely discrimination in schools.
Yeah,
100%, no doubt. And not only discrimination, but like separation of like. The Pākehā students and the Māori students. And that's not, it's not like an enforced thing, but it's just kind of naturally where people are gravitating towards, like you're with the people that you care about the most. And then mm-hmm. with that kind of becomes like a, you're not seeing other points of views, if that makes sense. I'm going a bit of a tangent here, but like, yeah, there's kind of this separation that I've noticed going from mainly being in a Pākehā space at school to slowly being more like treading that line. There's definitely a separation between the two. Mm-hmm. And the teachers see that as well.
Yep.
So they'll think of Pākehā students, Māori students, two different things, two different, but not always for the better.
And mm-hmm. do you sense a resentment from the Pākehā if there is any allowance made for the Māori children?
100%. Because me and Avalon are in year 13 this year. We are looking at, you know, this is a little anecdote, universities, scholarships, things like that. There's many scholarships for Māori students and, like,
And immigrants.
Yeah, immigrants and, former refugees. And things like that. And I've had conversations with people where they're like,
that's not fair.
Yeah, that's not fair. European or someone was like to me, oh, maybe I'll pull out my whatever amount they are, Māori, and then claim this scholarship.
Well, yeah. And you know, people fail to look at all the circumstances that have led to a government making those kinds of decisions.
Yeah, exactly. Those, these things are here for a reason.
The world isn't a level playing field, is it?
Mm-hmm.
The people starting from up there and there are others from right rock bottom.
Idea of equity versus equality.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's it. And this was something that was going on in Britain at the time in school. So they were those who absolutely resisted the type of ideas I was trying to promote at that time.
Mm.
In schools. And when I had to fight to demonstrate that these were good ideas, this is not about discriminating against white children or any other children, but it's about sharing good practice and education for all children.
Yes.
So eventually the message was starting to get through. And then when I became a head of a service, it was an English language support service, I had a mum come up to me and she said, I've read all about your work. And she said, but I have a different kind of problem. She said, my child doesn't really come from a fully ethnic background group. He is half black. And he's half of me, which is white. And I'm having a job getting him to school. He's a bright kid, she said. I know he's really intelligent, but he doesn't want to go into school because he said it's just not for him. I don't know what was going on in his school at that time, but I started to sit with her and ask her questions. And it turned out he felt he had no black identity. He was in an all-white area.
Yep.
He was with other white children. He was isolated. They called him names. They put him down. And he was intelligent enough to actually fight back at times. And he'd come home distressed and say to his mum, when I grow up, I just want to be white like you. Or I don't want to live at all. So there was no black presence in his home, sadly. His father wasn't around, so what could we do? And this was an area that I wasn't used to.
Yeah.
Therefore, I thought I was going to need help. I sought the help of a very successful black head teacher. And I'll give you his name because he's probably down in history, Carlton Duncan, in London. He headed several other schools. I said, help, what do I do? And he said, girl, he said, first thing you need to do, said, improve the self-identity of that child. Try it. And then he gave me a whole pack of ideas. He said, look, do you know? He said, all that boy's experience of black is that they are muggers, they're thieves, they're rogues, they're criminals, and the best thing they can do is play drums. So what else can you do? So we did a lot of research. And that's where the science came in, the maths came in, and he actually did some mentoring with that little boy.
Mm-hmm.
And my goodness, it didn't take long for bright little Josh to suddenly beam away, and he grew 6 inches taller. and then I heard later on that he really went on to do big things after school and achieve. So it worked with that one child, but not only those. We started a program on supporting the needs of dual heritage or mixed race children, whatever term you choose to use, and to be aware of their two different cultures or several in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
If you were third or fourth generation.
Yeah.
So you had several other cultures to bring into count and celebrate those cultures and don't belittle them. So there's a lot of great work going on in the 90s. And unfortunately, you know, it dwindles and we go back to our old ways.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether it's still going on, but that was our aim, was to make every child feel
empowered,
good about themselves, happy to be who they were. Their self-identity was so important, and their self-belief was the other thing, you know?
That is so special to hear, because all three of us are biracial, so we're all mixed.
We're all looking at each other right now like, oh my gosh, because I relate to literally everything you just said, you
100%, 100%.
Know?
100%.
Yeah. And my daughter, Tanya, of course, talked about her earlier.
Yeah.
She went through
the same
all
thing.
That, the same sort of racism. She was called all kinds of names, and I wasn't even aware of it at the time because she wouldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Children don't talk about these things to their parents. I mean, Josh was an exception, but Tanya never did. So I thought, I assumed she was happy in school, growing up in a stable home, and so on.
How does it feel? We just ended up there with Tanya.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to ask one last thing. Yeah. And it was, we've heard your story and all the amazing things you've done for the whole of the UK.
And
the impact, the whole of the world, well, and the impact that you've had. How does it feel seeing Tanya, your daughter, carry your legacy on and make all of these incredible things? Like, just myself personally, she has changed my life so much. Like, every time I see her and everything she's done for this community has, like, I don't think I would be anything like who I am if I didn't know Tanya and if she didn't have such a steady impact on my life. Mm-hmm. And I know that I'm speaking on the experience of probably hundreds of people, honestly.
That's so lovely to hear. Thank you. And I just couldn't be prouder of Tanya. Aww. I've got to say that. You know, the fact that she has just taken on board all the ideals that I worked for over 30 years in the education world.
Yeah.
She's just taken on board naturally and done quite a lot for Nelson.
Oh, my
God. With her music, with her music, her singing. She's approached people in the nicest of ways, and she's not pushy and harsh with the way she's with people. Mm-mm. She's actually tackled some pretty horrific situations in the nicest of ways.
With grace.
And thank you for mentioning her and for asking me today.
Well, it was such a pleasure to have you. We're going to close off with a song. Daphne, would you like to introduce the song that you picked?
Oh, well, I've chosen In the Ghetto by Elvis Presley. Now, if you're an old person, you will recognize that name. But the reason why I chose it, because it's about social justice. It's called In the Ghetto, and it's about a baby born in the ghetto. What chances does that baby have in life? Because nobody cares. And, well, if you listen to the lyrics, it's quite evocative in the sense that what options does that baby have?
Yeah.
And the mother cries as she gives birth to that child, knowing that she cannot give that child any advantages.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We love you so much. Have a safe trip back to England.
Yes. Oh, thank you for sharing your story with us.
As the snow flies on a cold and gray Chicago morning, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries, 'cause if there's one thing she don't need, it's another hungry mouth to feed in the ghetto. Now people, don't you understand? Your child needs your helping hand. He'll grow to be an angry young man someday. Take a look at you and me. Are we too blind to see? Do we simply turn our heads and look the other way? Well, the world turns, and a hungry little boy with a runny nose plays in the street as the cold wind blows in the ghetto. And his hunger burns. So he starts to roam the streets at night, and he learns how to steal, and he learns how to fight in the ghetto. Then one night in desperation, the young man breaks away. He buys a gun, steals a car, tries to run, but he don't get far, and his mama cries. As a crowd gathers round, an angry young man face down in the street with a gun in his hand in the ghetto. And as her young man dies on a cold and gray Chicago morning, another little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.